Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to www.njrevolutionradio.com. And I'm Jim Brash, and tonight I am speaking with Ryan Powers.
Besides, hi, Jim.
What's going on? Besides Brian,
I'm good.
A fellow of Green, a member of the Green Party of New Jersey at one point in time along with me, he is also one of the founders of 15 Now New Jersey. And that's what the subject is tonight. What will the proposal that Governor Phil Murphy is presenting will look like in relation to what working people actually need? And with that, I want to first ask you, Ryan, how do you feel about Governor Phil Murphy's proposal?
Well, there is no proposal right now, Jim. And whatever it's going to be is most likely going to be dog shit. You know, Team Sweeney will do whatever Norcross wants. And Don Norcross has said in repeated occasions that he only wants to raise it about a dollar a year. You'll still be in poverty that way, and his business buddies will still be rich, and absolutely nothing will change in our economy. Unless we start to, you know, honestly, Jim, I started with 15 Now right after Seattle raised their minimum wage. That inspired me and some comrades here in New Jersey. And that was, it's going on. We are into our fifth year of that campaign. And so when we say 15 Now, we meant 15 Now in 2013 or 2014. It is time to start talking about $20 to $25 an hour with inflation and, working our way towards less corporate ownership of private property. This, whatever dog shit the Democrats throw at us, ain't going to be nowhere near that. I can guarantee you it.
Okay. So when Phil Murphy's been talking about, I support a $15 minimum wage, he said a few times. He's also said he supports a living wage. In your opinion, that's just blowing smoke.
Well, look, I mean, we're always going to go by what's relative to the Democratic Party if we don't start to break that paradigm. And just because we have one rich guy saying he wants 15 in 3 or 4 years and another rich guy saying he's going to do it in 8 to 10 years doesn't mean those are the only options available to us as a society. And what we're allowing is a guy from Goldman Sachs and a guy from, you know, Norcross money to frame the debate. And I think we got to stop doing that. I don't know Phil Murphy. I don't pay a lot of attention to what Phil Murphy does, to be honest with you. Phil Murphy's the governor of the state of New Jersey. I'm a working class union representative, and we have very, very little in common. So what I've been focused on and what 15 Now Coalition should continue to be focused on is saying, hey, you know, we need to push way further than what we see on the table from even the most progressive of Democrats in these states.
Well, the way I see this is I saw San Francisco put out a bill that they passed $15 per hour in 3 years.
Yes. And that was passed when? I'm not aware of that.
Was that 2016 when they passed that?
3 years is the shortest I've heard. Most places have been 4 years. Traditionally the Democratic Party, which functions exactly like a corporation does, and exactly like ALEC does, on a structural level.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. They basically put model legislation together and they pass it out around the country and they have their corporate sponsored, politicians get it passed. It's no different than the Republican Party. So 4 years has pretty much been the standard, I think, which started in Seattle, which actually had an 8-year phase-in. And then as other places caught on, they made their phase-in kind of timed with Seattle's, which became 4 years as a standard.
Okay. Well, my thing is I come from a position of facts because I think people need to know the facts. The biggest fact is that wages have stayed stagnant since the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. That's fact. That's
right.
That's a fact that the right cannot deny. They try to deny it, but it's there glaring. Wages have stayed stagnant for now three decades. The profits are up. More importantly, worker productivity has continued to rise in spite of the fact wages has not risen with our productivity. Settling for anything less than a living wage that is tied to inflation going forward would be selling ourselves short. Which brings me to my next question. What are your thoughts on Fight for 15?
You mean because
the organization, the overall campaign that seems to be a partnership between unions and the Democratic Party?
Yeah, so they came along after 15 now, and we went to some early planning meetings with them, and they got us some good exposure and some good press. They did a lot of the lobbying work, and certainly 15 now represented on that coalition, and I'm proud of the work we did with them from a grassroots level, because I think when you've been involved in stuff, Jimmy, it's more than what you read in the papers. There was a lot of phone calls going on and people, you know, getting bodies to rallies and making sure that people were aware of this issue. So I think that that was a big positive, that it brought us that to that next level of organizing. So from that, perspective, I'm grateful for the experience with them. From a political level, we disagree strongly with them who, they kind of cater to what the Democrats would prefer to put on the table. And I think the 15 Now coalition stayed very much on the side of, you know, the working class and demanding that their real needs be met. So it's a political difference there, and a political approach is a little bit different. But overall, I mean, there was a lot of experience that was passed back and forth between our organizations. Unions have a lot to offer in the way of organizing experience and media relations and a lot of other important things when you're trying to, you know, build a movement. And they brought stuff to the table. I know I learned something from being involved with them, although, you know, we're not as involved with them today as we were going back maybe 2 years or so.
Okay. That leads me to the next question, which is around the country, we have seen a lot more pushback from the unions. Historically, unionism has been a retreat. Unions used to be a big part of the American landscape.
Yes.
It was okay to be Republican and proud and be union and proud during the 1950s and early
60s. It was normal.
I'm not positive, but what is it like less than 5% of the population are in unions now in the United States?
Depending on what study you look at, I see anywhere between 6 and 7% in the private sector, and in the public sector, it's somewhat higher. It's around about 30%.
Okay.
And that'll vary depending on, it'll vary depending on which study you read.
Thank you for the clarification.
No problem.
That said, do you see the onslaught of right to work having a direct, these right to work campaigns around the country having a direct correlation to the fight for 15, the fight for a living wage? And so that's the first part of the question. The second part, do you think, as a person who's on the inside of a union in a union office fighting for the common worker, do you believe that the union can push back against these right to work laws, which is a right to work, which basically means a right to work for less, and also fight on a separate front for a living wage? And the third part of that would be, do you think they can, that the unions can do much more organizing, even outside of, even meaning organizing workers who are not necessarily in a union, to fight those two fronts?
So I was scrolling around on the internet the other day, and I caught this clip of Fidel Castro talking to a reporter in the 50s after the revolution and after his government had been established, because he had been speaking about talking with the United Nations and stuff. So he'd been in charge for some time, I think like 3 or 4 years. And there was a lot of questions about the revolution. And one of the things Castro said repeatedly was, you know, he didn't think of it as a communist revolution. He didn't think of it as an ideological revolution. He and his comrades thought of it as a social revolution that was working from the ground up. They were reacting to the conditions, the material conditions, the social conditions that they were dealing with, you know, in their country. And I think that unions could be such a great force again in this country, but they can't exist in their current form. So when you say fight these right to work laws, I really don't care anymore what the federal government does, because they're all against us. And there's no friendly relationship with, you know, these corporate parties. And I really don't care at this point what laws they pass. And I would be more focused on a movement of working class people that can challenge the current power structure on a structural level, on that level of taking on the established organizations which make right to work possible. Right to work is going to pass. 15 is going to pass in some form, one way or another, not at a federal level, but around the country on a state level. But I would be more focused if we're worried about the effect on these laws on allowing that social revolution to take place. And where that can take place is in your local union hall, which to me, when I think of my union experiences and how I came up in the union movement, was being at my union meetings and learning about politics and learning about, various forms of economics, which were more favorable to the working class. So I don't know if that really answers your question. I don't worry about right to work anymore. I don't worry about this Janus case that's coming down. I know it's bad in the immediate future, but ultimately our movements will adapt to those new conditions on the ground if we focus on it, but it leads
to the conversation about whether or not we as workers are still in retreat. Whether or not we as laborers are actually having a labor movement, or are we just this disparate group of trade unionists and worker activists who are running around the country trying to get things done, but we're really not a movement. It leads to those other questions. Mm-hmm. It also leads to the questions of planning and organization. What does grassroots organizing look like from the ground up? You have firsthand knowledge of that.
Yes.
You have firsthand knowledge of dealing with union bureaucrats.
Yes. Yes. And you know what, Jim? All of those experiences have been wonderful.
Okay. What I'm getting at is like, and a big thing is, because I'm learning that here in this state. Yeah. For years, they've wanted to put, for example, for years, they've wanted to put on the ballot a ballot question about whether or not state employees' pensions should be fully funded or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, they want to do that because they know, and this is where our weakness as working class fighters comes to the fore. They know that the average worker who works in the private sector doesn't have guaranteed health or pensions.
Mm-hmm.
So to get those people to vote for something that they are not getting themselves is a very slim chance, which is why they went down the ballot. How do we build worker solidarity when we have situations like that? Like, what can we do? What can those of us who are in unions, I'm in a union, my experience has been shitty. That said, I understand the value of having a union.
Yes. Unions by far are not perfect. They're not
the value of having it, of having one. I still see them. I still know the history of them being fighting organizations. And I'm hoping for them to return to that in some form or fashion. Even if that means us creating new unions or taking over.
I think it has to. I think it. I think it has to lead to new formations. We're not going to continue to survive doing what we did in the 50s and 60s. It's a different world, man. Technology, automation, globalization, this international neoliberal power structure. None of that existed when we came up, and the union movement really hit its stride. Was after World War II, when Europe was decimated, bro. They had nothing. That place was leveled from World War II. Japan was a wreck. You know, we were the only place that could do anything because we hadn't been bombed to shit. So, you know, we don't have those conditions anymore. We're dealing with a new age. We're dealing with new challenges from technology to social media to all this other stuff. And we're going to be forced to change. The unions that we see before us that are successful in challenging this capitalist establishment will be the ones that survive long term and grow. That's my hope. You know, and I think that we will start to see that come into play, you know, hopefully over the next 10 years, because this next generation of people, the millennial generation, who I'm fortunate to have done some work with student organizing groups, man, they're different. They communicate differently. They think differently. And it's what they're going to do, Jim. Young socialists of today is going to blow our old minds. I'm telling you. And I think that's going to be part of what we see in a new union movement.
Okay. Because for me, I'm thinking also in terms of, I spoke with a friend of mine who's a trucker for Wakefern Corporation. They're already talking about, my friend is telling me, he has to be retired in 10 years because they're already talking about bringing in the automated trucks. And I'm in retail, and our biggest the biggest growth in our business has been online. I know the day is coming where they won't need me in a store, in a physical building.
Right.
It's coming. We have yet to, and for me, I'm seeing it as I get to year 18, 19 at my job. I'm seeing the horizon. I mean, well, not the horizon, but the light down the tunnel.
Yeah.
It ain't hope. It's an oncoming train. And
well, yeah. I mean, if we continue,
we're not attempting to even re-educate our workforce, and that's all to design. And I think people don't understand that those things are to design. They're purposely not re-educating the workforce because,
of course,
because you want, if you don't have an educated workforce, what you have a cheap workforce. So as long as we're dumbed down, they could get us on the cheap.
This country was built on slavery and free labor, and ever since they made us pay people, we've tried to do it as cheaply as possible because we believe in our institutions, we believe in slavery, and we apply it to whatever we can until we let go of that struggle for private property that makes us want to enslave each other or at least pay each other as little as possible. Then that's the circumstance.
The whole house of cards is based on exploitation and oppression.
Exactly.
And that goes through everything. But you, from a union perspective, how do we build worker solidarity between people who are not in a union and people who are in a union? Because I see that as being a big divide that we're going to have to cross at some point to make any lasting changes. I would love to see here in New Jersey UPS workers go on strike, and then all of a sudden every other damn worker in the state says, well, you know what, they're going on strike, we're going on strike too, and see freaking NJ Transit say, you know what, we're going to shut down this truck. Saying, we're going to shut down this. The air traffic controller saying, well, planes ain't moving. I would love to see that happen here. Rosa Luxemburg talks about the general strike and how it is one of the greatest tools we have at our disposal as workers, the ability to withhold our labor.
Yes. And
it doesn't happen. There used to be a time period where, you know, 30 years ago, you had Hormel meat packers going on strike, and you had Eastern Airline workers going on strike. The machinists were on strike, and maybe a decade or so ago, we had the UPS guys on strike. A couple years back, it was Verizon, and there was no – and in these more recent times, there's been no worker solidarity. I still go into the – I see a Verizon guy out front of the store saying, we're on strike. We're fighting for a better wage and better pensions. And I still go in the store and get myself a new iPhone through Verizon. It's
well, that, I mean, you're so you're asking how
an example. I don't actually have an iPhone, yeah. But I'm just saying what's happening. That's what you. That's what we're seeing. Like, okay, right. UPS is on strike, but you know what? Instead of me using the post office, I still need to use a UPS next day air. That's how I wanted to travel. Fuck that.
you were asking about how to build solidarity between union and non-union workers, right? And I did have a thought on that. You know, I think maybe you want me to answer that 15 now and issue-based stuff can do that, but I don't know that that's the only way.
I don't think that's the only way. I believe
I don't think the only way.
So
I think the real way is to organize the unorganized. And I know you want to build that bridge between the unorganized, but that's a social connection. So like I said, you only have 6% in the private sector right now, but if that was 20%, that means, you know, you go to a family party with 10 people and 2 people there are going to be in a union. You know, and you'll get to know. And again, unions will become normalized. So I think that unions need to innovate their approach to organizing. I think they need to become more welcoming institutions. I think that plays into doing work like, you know, my employer, CWA, Local 1033, you know, and number of other CWA locals have supported Black Lives Matter and done work like that. And supported the LGBT community and a number of other issue-based things. So I think when you do things like that, you send a message that, hey, you know, we're here for a larger community as well. And that's the issue-based part of it, you know? So I think there's ways that we could do better in organizing. And I think that builds community naturally. And it builds that kind of, that solidarity that you'd want to see. Because you may, you know what, a lot of people, you may go pick up a picket sign and go walk with your brother if he's on strike one day, or your mom, right. Or you know what I'm saying? And I think that could be the case.
But that leads to the next thing I want to bring up with you and ask you.
Yeah.
What does the electoral side of that looks like? Does that mean independent political action and we're in loose for that work of activists? Does that mean a Labor Party? What does that look like electorally to you?
What do I want it to look like, or what is it actually going to look like?
What do you want it to look like?
What do I want it to look like? I want to pull every dime away from our political system. And if we're going to do any political involvement, do it through parties that are completely funded by labor unions. I don't believe in our politics today. If there's not a green or a socialist or somebody I can vote for on the ballot, I don't vote, or I write in Mickey Mouse. I've voted for Eugene Debs repeatedly. You know, and the truth of it is, Jimmy, I believe that the corpse of Eugene Debs, which is lying in a grave somewhere, would still be a better congressman than most of the clowns that we have running Washington nowadays. So I just don't believe in electoral politics that much, man. You know, I just think that if we're going to run politicians, they should be fully funded by the working class.
Maybe we need to go to his museum and go to his museum and visit his grave in Terre Haute, Indiana somewhere. It's where he's buried at. maybe we need to go visit it. I still read his speeches that he gave 100 years ago. And they still resonate after 100 years.
His best thing he's ever read is his when he got sentenced for protesting. That is just a masterpiece, man. And you know, Debs was an inspirational dude.
He's standing there and he's giving that speech, and he basically calls the warmongering pigs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He calls them freaking coward. He called them cowards that wrapped themselves in patriotism. I mean, it was sending off some poor man's kid to be blown up when they will never sit off their own. It's just the way he did it was like brilliant. But he also said something else, and I want you to think about this and give an answer. That if he had the power to emancipate the working class, he wouldn't do it because it wouldn't stick. It wouldn't take hold. Yes. It has to be self-emancipation. He says that's the heart of for him being a socialist. It's about convincing people to emancipate themselves and to break their own chains.
Yes. Yes. It's
putting that out there in the into the ether.
Yeah, no, it's such an important message.
What does a fighting working class movement looks like to you? When you close your eyes, and there's people listening right now who are listening, who are going to be listening to this over and over, what vision do you have for working class movement?
A society of working class people that believe in themselves, that believe in their own power and their own strength and their own self-worth. I think that this capitalist society is trying to tell all of us how little we are worth and how wonderful and great these rich people are and that they are worth it. They're not worth it. To me, I would rather sit on the corner with a homeless person and drink a beer than sit in these boardrooms or in these ballrooms with these snobs and these horrible human beings who are creating war and poverty all over our country and acting as if they're better than us. They are worse than us. And I need people in this country to start to come to the realization that we have allowed some of the worst types of people to be in places of power. And they need to be removed from those places of power if we are to emancipate ourselves as a class. And that's the way I see it. We just have to believe in our ability to change the world. And then we can do it. Then we just have to do it.
What do you tell the skeptic, the cynic, the person who used to be an activist but isn't an activist no more, or the person who has looked at activists and said, that can't be me? What about the folks that don't know how to get started? What do you say to them?
Learning, I guess it's specific to every single person and what your passion is and what your talents and your skill sets lead to. I've gained quite a bit from mentorship in my life and watching more experienced, seasoned activists or union representatives, shop stewards, my chief steward. I can think back, John Fernandez at IBWA 27, showed me a lot of professionalism and a lot of ways of working, you know, as a grassroots, you know, working with my buddies on shop floor, you know, that's how I started. And he took me to that first level up to learn how to file a grievance and how to talk to management and that kind of shit. And there's dozens of John Fernandez's in my life who have shown me a way to do things or do things better. So you have to keep your mind very open. You have to be humble and know that you're around people that, you know, you need to respect their experience and their skill sets. And in return, they will respect yours. Once you gain them, you're going to find your own little place. You're going to find a place where you can be successful, where you can, you know, get whatever it is you need personally that's fulfilling from activism, as well as make a difference in the world. And that takes a little bit. Once you get there, it feels good. It feels good.
Okay. I have only a few more questions for you. I'm going to get to them real quick.
Sure.
Part of transforming the world, we transform ourselves. How has your activism, your trade unionism, being a socialist, well, how has that transformed your life? What has that done? Well, how has it added value to you doing what you do on a daily basis?
There's a lot.
Give us a few.
Yeah, I mean, I could touch on a number of things from how I interact with other people. I think a good example, I guess, is understanding race. I grew up in an all-white town. There was not one African-American family in my school until I hit high school, and then there was one. And literally, dude, it was such a big deal. They, like, put it in the paper that, like, black people were in Clark, and it was horrible. And it was really, you know, so I grew up in a very homogenous neighborhood. My first exposure to, like, different people really was in the military. I did do 4 years in the Navy, which I don't endorse doing, but I did it. I think that's where I first had some multicultural experience, and I started to realize that people were different than me, which, you know, as 18 years old came about hard. And then I think that benefited me in my working, you know, my days working with the labor unions and stuff like that. As I got into activism, I think I started to learn a lot more, especially with the Green Party, and noticed my own racist tendencies. You know, I'm more sensitive to how I use language and words and how I talk to my kids, how I deal with situations at work. All of that's been really impacted just from this one subject. But that could be said about a number of subjects. I'm using it as an example.
Yeah.
But it's, I wouldn't be this guy that I am today if it wasn't for my activism, if it wasn't for all these experiences. I'm the sum of that right now. And, you know, after a lot of therapy and some Lexapro, I kind of like me again. So I'll take it.
You know what? The alienation that is created under the capitalist system, it's, you talk, bring up depression and anxiety and those things. Yeah. That is a big byproduct of this system.
Yes.
That said, you are a father, a husband, a brother, a son, a friend. You've entered their world. You came into the world in a pretty shitty place, a pretty world. How do you want to leave it?
Oh, fully automated luxury communism. I don't know if we're going to get there in my lifetime.
In a phrase, I'm thinking about Muzak playing in the streets whenever you say that. Like some type of, I'm thinking of like some type of 1920s, 30s era Soviet by like a Muzak, but in Muzak almost. Right. That's what I'm thinking. Or some type of some music that you would have heard during the Cultural Revolution in China being played like Muzak right now. Another question, my last question for you is, what's next for you? What's next? Like,
well, yeah, New Jersey Revolution Radio.
Tell us about it. Just give a case of what is it about? What is this about that's got people like me interviewing you and people like Heather Warburton interviewing people and all these amazing people around New Jersey participating in this project? What is this project?
So my term with the Green Party is up June 1st. And I was looking around and I said, you know, I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do next. I knew I needed a little bit of a break from the Green Party, at least the executive portion of it, you know, and I'm just going to, you know, I'll still be with the party. I'm still going to help organize with them. I love my Green brothers and sisters and comrades. And at the same time, I was going to therapy, which I still go to. And my therapist made a recommendation that I start writing letters to myself or writing down my thoughts or something. I don't really have time for that. And I write enough at work and shit. So I said, why don't I just record myself. I talk to myself every morning on the way to work anyway. So why not record it? Right. And I did it a couple times and I sent a very early podcast, which I don't think I ever made public, to Gary Frazier and some other people. And I said, what do you think of this? I thought it was interesting. And I got some decent feedback. So I said, you know, maybe I'll put a little podcast up. And it's turned into me talking to myself on the turnpike into kind of like a mini media company right now. We've got some exciting things happen. We've got regular contributors. I've got a couple of donors. It's a cheap thing that I'm running right now, but it's going way faster than I thought it would. About 100 people look at our site a day right now, and that's nowhere near. I mean, I thought I'd be lucky if, like, right now at this point, maybe 10, 15 people tune in a week. You know, I mean, I honestly, like, this was kind of like a side gig, and I was going to just kind of, you know, muddle along and see how well I could do it. Heather coming on board, the new graphics on it, the web. She's done some great work on, you know, helping us get the logo up on the site and everything. And it's coming together faster than I thought. I don't know where it's going. I'll be honest with you, because right now I'm just trying to keep up making platforms for the artists that come on board and trying to figure out ways that I can, you know, get people to the site and get people to contribute, like, you know, and that's why I'm so grateful to you and Heather and everybody and Madeline Hoffman and all the people that have done interviews with us. You know, we've put together almost, I think, 50 podcasts already. So, you know, that's keeping it rolling. And man, it feels good right now. It's meaningful work. I think it's important and serious work. It's also, it's given me a little new breath of life. I'm looking forward to where it goes.
All right. Well, you know what, Brian? Thank you for allowing me to help you build this platform. And thank you for chatting with me. Do you have anything else about the fight for workers to live that you want to share?
If you're in the working class and you hear this, just build up your self-esteem and fight for what you believe in. Don't take shit from no bourgeois scum trying to tell you who to be and what you're worth. You're worth what you believe you're worth. And take that attitude on and then go change the world. You can do it. I'll help you do it. Get in touch with us at New Jersey Revolution Radio. You know, go to the website, click on Contact Us and tell us, you know, if you want to get involved with something. You know, you, Jim, between me, you, Heather, and all these wonderful activists that are involved with NJRR, we know an organization you can get with to make a difference, you know? So give us a shot. We'll help you out.
And with that, I will say thank you and have a great night, comrade.
Thanks a lot, man. It's went really well.